I am not by training a Luther scholar. I'm a Hebrew Bible person. My wife is a Reformation historian and Luther scholar, and this book that we were asked to produce by Fortress Press is a joint project that she and I worked on together, and it just so happened that it worked out to be a true collegial working project. My training is in Hebrew Bible and also the history of Jewish biblical interpretation, and so I have had a long-standing and deep interest in Judaism for many years now, and this happened to be a project that my wife and I came together in a way that we could really enjoy common interests. It's been a difficult project, but we were able to spend 3 summers in Germany together, which was great. And, don't get to go back this summer. The money has run out. I'm going to be speaking to you for about an hour, no more. And simply what I want to do is to try to share with you the primary learnings that I had over the course of researching this book. The title of the book, by the way, is Martin Luther, the Bible and the Jewish People. And it's a reader intended for both seminary and graduate students to introduce students to this very difficult topic. So what I've learned, and we'll go at it and take a break, and then hopefully we'll have the opportunity for some give-and-take conversation. I'm sure that there will be questions about this. So here we go, and the 3 major sections in my presentation. The first is entitled, Why This Book? Why This Particular Book Project at This Particular Time? On October the 31st, 2017, the city of Lutherstadt Wittenberg and Lutherans throughout the world will commemorate the 500th anniversary of the posting of Martin Luther's 95 Theses and the beginning, the traditional beginning of the Protestant Reformation. The years leading up to this commemoration have been designated by the EKD, or the Evangelical Protestant Church in Germany, as the Lutherdekade, the Luther Decade. And this date will mark a significant milestone for Lutherans specifically, but also for Protestants in general. It is also an opportune moment, my wife and I are convinced, an opportune moment to revisit a grim problem at the heart of Lutheran and Protestant origins, which is that of Luther and the Jews. The place, significance, and influence of Martin Luther in the long history of Christian anti-Jewish polemic has been and continues to be a deeply contested issue. The literature on the subject is substantial and diverse, and virtually all of the good stuff is in German and has not been translated. While efforts to absolve Luther as simply a man of his times, as one who merely passed on and perpetuated what he himself had already received from his cultural and theological tradition, have generally been jettisoned, there still persists, even among the educated public, the perception that the truly problematic aspects of Luther's anti-Jewish attitudes are confined to the final stages of his career. That is, that the problem of Luther and the Jews is best seen as a problem of the late or the old Luther. And just for those of you that may not know, the dates of Luther, 1483, he's born, dies in 1546. So 1483-1546 is one we're talking about here. But to be sure, one can speak of an intensification of anti-Jewish rhetoric toward the end of Luther's life. There's no question about this, especially with regard to the question of what should be done practically about the Jews of Saxony in particular and of Germany in general. But the first point I want to make with you today is that Luther's theological evaluation of Judaism and the Jewish people remains essentially unchanged from the earliest stages of his career. And this has been bluntly articulated by the great Reformation historian Heiko Obermann, and I quote him, "The basis of Luther's anti-Judaism was the conviction that ever since Christ's appearance on earth, the Jews have had no more future as Jews," end quote. I'll be bringing several quotes this afternoon, and we can revisit those in the question and answer session. Related to this static aspect of Luther's theological thought is the significance of it. When one reads Luther with a careful eye toward the Jewish question, and without a predisposition to exonerate him, it becomes apparent that far from being tangential, the Jews are rather a central core component of his thought, and that this was the case throughout his career and not just at the end. If this is in fact so, then it follows that it is essentially impossible to understand the heart and the building blocks of Luther's theology, things like justification, faith, salvation, grace, freedom, law, and gospel, and so forth. It's impossible to understand the basic building blocks of Luther's theology without acknowledging the crucial role played by the Jews in his fundamental thinking. But Luther was indeed constrained by ideas, images, and superstitions regarding the Jews and Judaism that he inherited from medieval Christian tradition. But the engine in the development of Luther's theological thought as it relates to the Jews is his biblical hermeneutics. And as we are arguing in the introductory portions to our book, in particular, his Old Testament hermeneutics. We're convinced that this is the engine in the whole thing. It is not commonly appreciated that Luther, the university professor, lectured far more on the Old Testament than he did on the New. Just as the Jewish question is a central core component of his thought, so biblical interpretation, and especially Old Testament interpretation, is the primary arena in which essential claims about the Jews and Judaism are formulated and developed. And to a degree, this sets Luther apart from much of the theological tradition that had preceded him. Luther's anti-Judaism, we would argue, is predominantly biblically based and biblically driven rather than culturally or socially based. You know, there are different types of anti-Judaism and anti-Semitism. We can talk about those distinctions later. And this aspect of Luther's thinking vis-a-vis the Jews has had no small impact on subsequent Lutheran biblical interpretation, especially as it relates to the Old Testament. No contemporary study of the history of Christian attitudes toward and teaching about Judaism can avoid its own post-Holocaust context. This context affects the questions we ask of historical documents, persons, and events, as well as why we ask them in the first place. It may even contribute to why we are interested in certain historical matters at all. The Holocaust has forever changed the rules of engagement for all matters Jewish-Christian. On the other hand, a highly developed historical consciousness also reminds us that there are no straight lines in history. History is too complex and too capricious to tolerate the imposition of arguments of historical inevitability. Luther, for example, did not make the Führer inevitable. But history can teach broad lessons, and especially the history of Christian Europe. When seen in this light, Martin Luther takes his place alongside that legion of Christian thinkers and leaders both before and after him that forcefully advocated and participated in the expulsion or deportation of Jews. Over the course of his career, Luther came to the conclusion that Christian and Jewish coexistence could not be achieved, nor should it be. In addition, no reasonable reading of Luther, we would argue, can avoid the conclusion that his statements and beliefs about the Jews further contributed to their dehumanization by Christians, both in thought and in practice. Despite the revolutionary, religious, social, and political character of Luther's Reformation, it did nothing to make matters any better for the lives of actual European Jews. In terms of Luther's immediate legacy in the late 16th and early 17th century, Thomas Kaufmann has recently written, at the level of confessionally distinct identities, Lutheran could be the same as anti-Jewish. End quote. Contemporary Lutheran Christians, and indeed any Christian, would argue, who has been positively affected by Martin Luther's courageous articulation of the gospel, have a moral obligation to reckon with how Luther sounded and how Luther sounds to Jewish ears. The explicit focus of our particular book on Luther and the Jews is warranted for many reasons, but it is perhaps stated most poignantly by Heiko Obermann. This is a quote I want you to hear clearly. "The terrible tragedy of the relationship between the Jews and Christians in world history can be studied in concentrated form in the history of this one man." And I'll repeat that. "The terrible tragedy of the relationship between the Jews and Christians in world history can be studied in concentrated form in the history of this one man." That's from Obermann's famous book, Luther, Man Between God and the Devil. Part two. What Luther knew and thought of Judaism. What Luther knew and thought of Judaism. There are a few subjects historically that Christians have written more about and known less about than Judaism. And perhaps nowhere is this clearer than in the case of Martin Luther. Luther had neither Jewish conversation partners nor Jewish friends. His knowledge of Judaism, apart from the Bible, was primarily dependent on what he read, and those readings were dominated by overtly anti-Jewish treatises, some of which were written by Christians and some by Jewish converts. Though classical Jewish texts were becoming widely available to Christian scholars during the time of Luther's academic career, by his own admission, he was not in position to handle these texts for himself. Thus, his descriptions of Judaism and Jewish thought are, at best, partial truths and caricatures, though there is no reason to suspect that he himself did not regard them as factually accurate. Ironically, and this is a point where my wife and I actually disagree, ironically, if Luther had learned more about Judaism, it likely would have made no real difference to him. That's my take. And for example, to highlight this, when in the year 1530, the Jewish convert Antonius Margherita translated substantial portions of the Jewish daily liturgy into German for the first time, Luther found in these prayers confirmation for his own unflinching anti-Jewish stance. Where the Jews are concerned, Luther sees a rupture between the Judaism of biblical times and that of post-biblical times. That is, the time prior to the coming of the Christ and the time during and after his coming. So when Luther is speaking about Jews, you always have to be careful about which Jews he's talking about, right? The Jews of the biblical period or post-biblical Jews. The significance of this crucial distinction is captured on the very first page of Heinrich Bornkamm's classic study on Luther and the Old Testament. And Bornkamm writes as follows. Luther's quarrel with the Judaism of his own day must not be treated as a repudiation of the Old Testament. To do so would prevent any understanding of what the Old Testament meant to him. Luther made a clear and sharp distinction between the two. No one who has even superficially looked into Luther's writings can doubt his passionate opposition to the Jews as blasphemers of Christ on the one hand, and his deep love for the Old Testament on the other. He had no difficulty maintaining both, as paradoxical as this may appear to some people today. End quote. The watershed moment for Luther, that is, that which brings about the distinction between the two periods in the way in which he thinks about Judaism, is the overwhelming and the ongoing no of the Jews, the Old Testament people of God, to Jesus as the Christ. Few Christian thinkers, have been more genuinely troubled, even tormented, by this no than was Martin Luther. Over his entire career, he struggled to find a plausible explanation to account for how it could be. Like most before him, he regarded the Roman destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in 70 of the Common Era as the strict judgment of God visited on the Jews for the crucifixion of Christ. And the interminable exile of the Jews, which by Luther's time was approaching 1,500 years, became for Luther definitive, empirical proof that God had cast the Jews off and that they were obviously no longer the people of God. Though he never tires of taunting the Jews in his writings with the 1500 years argument, and when he's arguing with the Jews, 1500 years is like a mantra, you know, 1500 years, 1500 years. He never tires of taunting the Jews with the 1500 years argument. It's not difficult to perceive that Luther himself was actually terrified by what he knew of Jewish life in the European diaspora. Being landless, always vulnerable to persecution and expulsion, and lacking any clear word from God regarding the end of their exile, all of these embody for Luther what it looks like to live life under the wrath of God. It was unthinkable to him that the promises of the biblical prophets could have remained unfulfilled for so long as the Jews claimed, because this contradicted Luther's most basic convictions about the nature of God. Luther certainly believed that God on occasion punishes God's own people, even severely. The biblical record, of course, is too clear on this issue. But for Luther, God would not, you could even say God could not, punish the Jews in the way they are being punished if they were still God's own people. The only tenable explanation for him was that the promises of the prophets had passed to another people. Otherwise, as Luther repeats tirelessly, otherwise, God would be a liar. Luther was honestly baffled by how the Jews could continue to deny the reason for their miserable 1500-year exile, especially when the witness of Scripture was so evident to him. Over the course of his career, he would come to the conclusion that the only thing, finally, that could explain it was that they had been handed over by God to the devil. And thus their resistance to the gospel and their resistance to admitting the reason for their exile was willful and unforgivable. Though it was not typical of Luther, this thoroughgoing demonization of the Jews led late in his career to the dredging up and repeating of scurrilous accusations to the effect that it was in the nature of Jews to want to kill Christians. A particularly repulsive example that I discovered comes from his 1544 Lenten lectures on Isaiah 53, just 2 years before his death. These have never been translated. Commenting on Isaiah 53:8, the verse that speaks of the death of the servant of the Lord, Luther, echoing the centuries-old blood libel accusation, states as follows: "The Jews still kill Christ daily. Not in the sense that they merely desire to do so, but rather in fact. For they slaughter many Christian infants and children. In short, they are killers forever." End quote. Of all of the theological charges that Luther levels against the Jews, the most consistently recurring one has to do with the issue of chosenness or election. That is, the Jewish claim to be the chosen people of God based upon physical descent from Abraham. Luther readily grants that the Jews are indeed Abraham's physical descendants, but that they have consistently misconstrued the nature of God's promise to Abraham. For Luther, the promise to Abraham's seed was in reality the promise of the seed, that is, the Messiah or the Christ, who is first announced in Genesis 3:15. The physical seed of Abraham, the Jews, were God's chosen instrument in Old Testament times to bear that promise. But Abraham's true descendants, Abraham's true seed, according to Luther, even in Old Testament times, were always those who believed in the promise of the Messiah and not those who relied on their physical descent. This is the fundamental error and sin of the Jews, who trust, as it were, that they have been born into grace, that they are bound to God by birth, and thus that God owes them God's benevolence. For Luther, if you know anything about him, this constitutes a theological obscenity. Because the grace and benevolence of God can only be accessed by faith. And it has never been otherwise for Luther. It has never been otherwise. The only thing the human being, the Jew included, is born into is sin. The human being has nothing of its own that can be held up to God, and certainly not its own birth. God owes the human being nothing, according to Luther. The Jewish claim of chosenness, therefore, becomes the quintessential example of what Luther means by boasting in the flesh. And it is at the root of his understanding of Judaism as a purely carnal religion that knows nothing of the spiritual or the eternal. That's what Luther thinks of Judaism. It is a purely carnal religion that knows nothing of the spiritual or the eternal. Now, this boast of the Jews carries with it two corollaries that Luther pursues with vigor. The first is what he understands by the completely exclusive character of Jewish chosenness. If the Jews are God's chosen people, then it follows, for Luther, that everyone else is damned, Luther included. And the second corollary follows immediately from the first. If the Jews claim salvation exclusively for themselves, as Luther is convinced that they do, then they are by definition despisers of the rest of humanity and ultimately misanthropoi, or misanthropes. The misanthropic character of Jewish life and hope crystallizes for Luther around Jewish messianic expectation, which, as he understands it, longs for the messianic annihilation of all the Gentiles, and such longing is illustrated by the love the Jews have for the book of Esther, a book that he particularly detested. Now, these are radically serious charges, but Luther was equally radical in his conviction of their veracity. To be fair to him, Luther was not making these charges up out of thin air. This is an important point. He was not making these charges up out of thin air. Since at least the 12th century, there had indeed developed in European Jewish circles a strident anti-Christian literature, a literature which satirized Christian beliefs, attacked Christian exegesis, and longed for the destruction of the enemies of the Jewish people. Now, aspects of this anti-Christian polemic, this medieval Jewish anti-Christian polemic, had filtered down to Luther, and he was acutely offended by it. But beyond the offense he experienced, Luther came to believe and to teach that the most extreme anti-Christian positions articulated by Jews, in the wake of the Crusades, no less, were definitive of Jewish thought as such. And this without regard to the increasingly desperate situations that it contributed to the rise of this type of literature in the first place. But the picture of the Jew and of Judaism that thus emerges in Luther's thought is not a pleasant one. While other leading 16th century reformers also wrote against the Jews, many of them did, all of the leading ones did, while other reformers also wrote against the Jews, Luther outpaced them all, both qualitatively and quantitatively. And though no single explanation can account for this phenomenon, the sheer fact itself highlights the centrality of the Jew in Luther's mind. And thus Thomas Kaufmann can write that, quote, "The Jews represented for Luther the opposite of what it meant to be a Christian or what it ought to mean." It was not an issue of complementarity or some such thing, but of diametric opposites. The Jew represented for Luther the opposite of what it meant to be a Christian or what it ought to mean. Kaufmann's words are consistent with the equally broad claim made by Wilhelm Maurer in his landmark study of over a half century ago. For Luther, quote, "The post-biblical Jew is the archetype of the human being standing in opposition to God," end quote. Now, if the Jew is archetypal of the human condition vis-a-vis God, then it follows that the ultimate human problem that Christ and the gospel have to remedy is the Jew inside us all. Thus, for Luther, and this is the case throughout his career, the Jew and Judaism represent the negative religious standard against which all other negative religious phenomena are finally measured. I know that's a pretty heavy statement, but I'm prepared to stand by it. One does not have to read far in Luther to encounter his unholy threesome of the Jew, the Pope, and the Turk. The Jew, the Pope, and the Turk as the prime enemies of the gospel. Given the frequency of the recurrence of this phrase, and especially given the similarity of language that Luther uses to attack all three members of the group, the criticism is occasionally made that attempts to isolate the question of Luther and the Jews are misguided, and that the Jewish question therefore should not be privileged. It's an important argument. I disagree with it, 100%. Without minimizing Luther's anti-papist or anti-Turkish language, our work follows that line of Luther scholarship that nevertheless argues for a qualitative distinction where the Jews are concerned in Luther's thought, which for us turns on three points. The first has already been mentioned in regard to the archetypal role that the Jews play in Luther's thought. That's the first. The second is similar. For Luther, the Jews were the first enemies of the gospel, and their hostility has never ceased. The current popes, and certainly the Turks, are relative latecomers in the battle against Christ and the gospel. In Luther's view of church history, the gospel has its sworn enemies in every generation, and he did come to believe that the Pope and the Turk were in fact the final apocalyptic enemy, the Antichrist. But the Jews are once again distinct, because they and they alone have the character of being the perennial enemies of the gospel. To paraphrase a passage from the Gospels themselves, we might say it this way, the Jew you always have with you. In this regard, the Jews share that role only with the devil himself, in Luther's thought. But there's a third point that is decisive for us, and that is the question of social location. The Pope, it's easy to say, was the most religiously powerful person in Europe. Luther's rhetorical attacks against the Pope took true courage, placed his life in real jeopardy, and resulted in a strict geographical confinement for most of his career. Luther was stuck for most of his life, for most of his academic life. He couldn't move. He was stuck. The Turk, on the other hand, had a mighty army. And though the threat to Germany was genuine, it nevertheless remained at a distance. Luther's writings against him did not have the slightest effect upon it. But for the Jews of Germany and neighboring lands, I think that we can say Luther was a player. Both through his writings and his personal influence on Protestant princes, Luther helped to make the lives of his Jewish contemporaries more precarious and influenced the imaginations of subsequent generations of Lutherans toward Jews in numerous deleterious ways. The issue at stake here is not whether Martin Luther was the most virulent anti-Christian writer ever. He wasn't. Nor is it whether he said equally repulsive things about other groups. He did. It is rather about the precariousness of the Jewish social situation in Luther's day. And all three of these points, when taken together, warrant an explicit focus on Luther and the Jews as a qualitatively distinct issue. Now, in light of the derogatory views just described, there may seem to be a contradiction. And did were any of you able to read that Jesus Christ was born a Jew before coming to class? Some of you are familiar with this? No. But there may seem to be a contradiction with what is often referred to as the Jew-friendly side of Luther, as expressed most notably in his 1523 treatise that Jesus Christ was born a Jew. But I would submit to you that the contradiction is only a seeming one. At no point in his career does Luther ever express hope for the Jew as Jew. At no point. Judaism is a dead religion, and Luther makes no distinction between Judaism and those who practice it, the Jews. What he says about one applies to the other. You know, it's a distinction that we modern people tend to make, you know, what religious persuasion we are and what we are as human beings. But Luther, he makes, does not make the distinction. What he does express, in varying degrees, is a hope for the Jew to become a Christian. The phrase Jew-friendly Luther only makes sense if it refers to the degree of openness to or optimism about Jewish conversion to Christianity. And even as early as his lectures on Romans, 15:15, 15:16, he expresses skepticism about readings of Romans 11 to the effect that all Jews would convert at the end of time, which was pretty much the tradition of the Roman Catholic Church in terms of the history of the exegesis of that passage. Luther is already at the very beginning of his career expressing misgivings about that reading of the passage, and by the end of his career he would reject it altogether. In the early 1520s, however, he does go through a period when he manifests significant optimism toward the prospect of the conversion of a number of Jews. And this is the period out of which this particular treatise comes. But this optimism was to be short-lived, and already by the mid-1520s, it disappears and never returns again. What does remain roughly consistent is his conviction, expressed most noticeably in his commentary on the Magnificat from June of 1521, that there will always be Christians, however few, among Abraham's seed, the Jews, and that therefore, insofar as possible, Christians should treat Jews in a kindly manner. That stays roughly consistent throughout his career. Ironically, it is the period of Luther's greatest optimism regarding Jewish conversions that also highlights his thoroughgoing negative evaluation of Jews and Judaism. While in hiding on the Warper, and virtually at the same time as he wrote his Magnificat commentary, he also wrote a commentary on Psalm 68 in May of 1521. Within the space of 1 month, the same person who wrote that the Jews should be treated in a kindly manner in hopes of their conversion also wrote the following about Psalm 68:21, and the quote is, "But God will shatter the heads of his enemies, the hairy crown of him who walks in his guilty ways." This is what Luther is commenting on. And he writes, and this is during his optimistic period, okay? "It is known well enough that the Jews have at all times been Christ's greatest enemies, their claim to be God's most loyal friends notwithstanding. It is undeniable that this verse chronicles their fate. Their head is shattered. They no longer have a kingdom, a government, a priesthood. Soon after Christ's ascent, they lost that head and never regained it, which is the result of but one crime, namely their hostility to Christ and their refusal to let him be God. All this is the consequence of their refusal to believe in him who takes away both sin and death, and of their persistence to remain in their guilty ways, as our text declares." Luther's unrelenting negativity toward Judaism and those who practice it, the Jews, never changed. And his legacy in this regard is summarized by Peter von der Ossensacken, who's written a very important recent book on Luther and the Jews, on Luther's legacy. I quote him: "Luther's anti-Jewish writings belong in the front row of treatises, speeches, and sermons delivered against the Jews in all of church history." Oh, that's the end of part two, and part three is a little shorter. How are we doing on time, Charles?
Terrific. Quarter after,
Thanks.
Thanks.
All right, this last section, I've given it the general title, The Engine, and there are three subsections under that, The Engine in Luther's anti-Jewish thinking and writing. And the first subsection under The Engine I've entitled Luther and the Old Testament. The corpus of Luther's collected works reaches beyond 100 large volumes and is still not complete. Have you ever seen the Weimar on the shelf? Have you ever seen this puppy? Mm. This is the work of one dude. Not of all of which comes from his pen, but much of it was dictated, taken by dictation. But it's still not complete, you know. The size of the collection and its numerous literary genres can have the effect of obscuring what was at the heart of Luther's life work, namely his academic lectures on books and portions of books of the Bible at the University of Wittenberg, which spanned a 32-year teaching career. Though Luther's academic title was Professor in Biblia, Professor of Bible, he devoted only 3 or 4 years to lectures on New Testament books. He only ever lectured on Romans, on Hebrews, and twice on Galatians. Only New Testament books he ever lectured on. The remainder of his teaching years were completely given over to the Old Testament. While so much of what Luther wrote was dictated by ecclesiastical and political circumstance over the course of his career, these university biblical lectures represent his own free choices and thus reveal something essential about his own theological orientation as intently focused on the Old Testament and its interpretation. It's also important to note that Luther's engagement with the Old Testament was not limited to or restricted to the lecture hall. During the 1520s alone, Luther preached 62 sermons on Genesis, 65 on Exodus, 32 on Leviticus and Numbers, and 17 on Deuteronomy. That's just during the 1520s. He also wrote numerous commentaries or expositions on Psalms and collections of Psalms, and several of his polemical treatises are centered on Old Testament texts or themes. And last but not least, and it's often underestimated, was the Old Testament translation project that involved Luther and his team of translators, what he called the Wittenberg Sanhedrin. It involved Luther and his team of translators for 12 years, from 1523 until 1534. And then on to the end of his life as the translation was repeatedly revised. By any estimation, the Old Testament and its proper interpretation were at the core of Luther's thought. For our purposes, the crucial issue was noted by the great Jewish scholar Salo Baron in stating that, quote, Luther's lifetime preoccupation with the Old Testament made him, on the whole, less rather than more friendly to contemporary Jews, end quote. Why this was the case is directly anchored in the way Luther insisted that the Old Testament should be, in fact, must be, read by Christians. And this takes us to the second subsection, which is Old Testament interpretation proper. Luther inherited from his medieval forebears the tradition of interpreting biblical texts, and especially Old Testament texts, according to a fourfold meaning. And this fourfold sense was usually defined as the literal, the allegorical, the tropological, and the anagogical, which, at least theoretically, tended to correspond to the historical meaning of the text, the meaning for the church, the meaning for the individual, and finally, the eschatological meaning. Now, this fourfold medieval hermeneutical method was actually an elaboration upon the ancient church's twofold distinction between the literal and the spiritual, which we find already in the New Testament, especially in Paul, and especially in 2 Corinthians 3. The fourfold meaning was a complexification of the ancient Christian twofold method of interpretation. Now, the relationship between Luther and medieval exegesis, as he developed as an interpreter, is exceedingly complex, and it is exceedingly dense. We're not going into it today. Though it has often been portrayed as a rupture, that is clearly too strong as evidenced by the fact that Luther continued to use allegory throughout his career. He never, people always say, you know, Luther turned away from allegory. Well, he didn't. No, he didn't. He used it throughout his entire career until the very end. But what Luther did do was seek to simplify the interpretation of the Bible. This is seen most clearly in his conviction, already evident by 1518 or 1519, that biblical texts rightly ought to have one proper or legitimate meaning. This is his biblical hermeneutical discovery, that biblical texts rightly ought to have one proper or legitimate meaning. As long as there was agreement on this proper or legitimate meaning as the foundation, Luther had no problem whatsoever in bringing other interpretations to enhance or illustrate it. But in addition, the proper or legitimate meaning served to limit other readings, that is, readings that he regarded as utterly fanciful or in no way related to the legitimate meaning. Thus, we can say that simplification and limitation are important terms for understanding Luther's approach to biblical interpretation vis-a-vis his medieval forebears. On the other hand, Luther was quite flexible when it came to the issue of the application of a text to the present day, the type of thing that preachers do on a weekly basis. Because he was convinced that Scripture, when properly understood, was a living thing, it could speak in concretely different ways in different times and places. And Luther never made any claim to have exhausted the potential applications of Scripture. But what about the relationship between the Old Testament and Judaism? And here, I find three aspects of Luther's thought as all determinative. The first has to do with the most basic of all Christian theological claims, traditionally, the Messiahship of Jesus, or stated differently, Jesus Christ. More precisely, it is the conviction that the Christ proclaimed in the New Testament is the same Christ promised in numerous passages in the Old Testament, and in addition, that this equivalence of the one promised and the one proclaimed can be proven by the proper interpretation of these key Old Testament texts. That's the issue, that it can be proven, according to Luther. Now, in this regard, there is nothing new or especially unique in Luther, as his primary proof texts, Christological proof texts, are essentially the same as those used by Justin Martyr and by Tertullian, you know, in the mid and late 7th century. What is characteristic of Luther is his seeming need to argue this point against the Jews over and over and over again, literally ad nauseum. I'm not kidding you. Literally ad nauseum. And so the question emerges, why? Why does he feel the need to repeat it so much? And I think a reasonable answer is simply that Luther perceived in Jewish readings of the Old Testament a genuine threat. Precisely because this was for him the most basic of all theological issues, that Jesus is the Messiah promised in the Old Testament, it had to be sustained, otherwise the entire edifice would collapse. From Luther's perspective, Jewish interpretation represented an assault on the very foundations of Christianity itself. And once you're able to appreciate this, then you can also see why Luther was so harsh toward his Christian contemporaries who were making use of Jewish readings of the Old Testament. Because he was convinced that these Christian interpreters were sawing off the limb on which they themselves were sitting. For Luther, there could be no compromise on this most basic of all theological issues. Jewish interpreters and Christians who interpreted like Jews had to be attacked and defeated on the Old Testament battlefield, because everything from a religious point of view was at stake. The second aspect flows directly out of this first one, and this was really an important discovery for me in putting many things together around this particular topic. For Luther, the Old Testament, properly understood, is a Christian book. The Old Testament, properly understood, is a Christian book. And the two volumes of the Christian Bible, therefore, constitute a theological unity. This is what enables Luther to speak of the church as being present already in the Old Testament. You read Luther's lectures on Genesis, and he's talking about the church in Genesis. Where does this come from? This is what enables him to speak of the church as being present already in the Old Testament, and to speak of certain Old Testament characters as Christians. I mean, Luther calls Abraham a Christian. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, they're all Christians. Even Moses, sometimes, can be called a Christian. What binds the two volumes of the Christian Bible together is the promise of the coming of the Messiah and faith in that promise. For Luther, the faith of the Old Testament and the faith of the New Testament are the same. And thus, the criteria for determining who are and are not the people of God are also the same. The only significant distinction is that Old Testament Christians trust in the one who will come, while New Testament Christians trust in the one who already has come. And Luther can even say, and he clearly believes this, Luther can even say that Old Testament faith was actually superior to New Testament faith. That's why he loves the patriarchs and matriarchs of Genesis so much. Old Testament faith was actually superior to New Testament faith because the saints of the Old Testament trusted, contrary to all appearances, in a pure promise. A pure promise. Once one recognizes Luther's understanding of the Old Testament as a Christian book, not by adoption, but in its essence, then another claim of his, which on the surface seems very peculiar, makes perfect sense. This is Luther's idea that what happens when a Jew converts to Christianity, according to Luther? What is really happening when a Jew converts to Christianity? According to Luther, the Jew is returning to the faith of his or her forebears. When a Jew converts to Christianity, the Jew is returning to the faith of his or her forebears. That's a strange notion. Yes? But it's consistent with his broader understanding that the New Testament and Christianity represent theological continuity with the Old Testament, while Rabbinic Judaism and Rabbinic texts are in complete theological discontinuity. In fact, they are an utter aberration. The third aspect I only want to mention to you, only allude to it, and it has to do with Luther's use of Old Testament curse and judgment language. He's interpreting curse and judgment language in Old Testament texts. What does he do with this? And what I've discovered is that aside from the strictly Christological proof texts that we've been talking about, it is actually in these areas, Old Testament curse and judgment language, where much of his anti-Jewish polemic emerges. And this is an area of Luther's thought that still requires a whole bunch of scholarly attention, and I'm very interested to get at some of this myself. But one thing is clear, at least it's clear to me at this point. In theological terms, much of the worst of what Luther had to say about the Jews occurs in the context of his wrestling with Old Testament judgment language, for it was precisely there that he found the shocking possibility that God can cast off God's own people. All right, here's the conclusion. Thanks for bearing with me. The last entry is entitled The Problem of the Hebrew Bible, i.e., the Rabbis. The Problem of the Hebrew Bible, i.e., the Rabbis. Mm. an obvious problem for Luther, and indeed for anyone who wants to argue for the theological unity of the Christian Bible, is the fact that the Old Testament is written in a language wholly unrelated to the Greek New Testament. As a young scholar, Martin Luther made himself a student of biblical Hebrew. As early as 1508, 1509, he's beginning to study Hebrew. And he continued to work with the language until the end of his life. Now, Luther was an expert Latinist. In fact, Luther was completely bilingual in Latin and German. Completely bilingual. He was an expert Latinist. He also had very fine Greek skills. But by his own admission, his competence in biblical Hebrew did not approach that of his Greek, and certainly not that of his Latin. This did not deter him, however, from often making very bold theological claims based on his faulty understanding of certain nuances of the Hebrew language. And for Lutherans, this is a rather painful discovery to read some of the arguments that Luther creates based upon Hebrew exegesis that is... I'll leave it at that. An even more significant problem for Luther was his discovery of the Jewish interpretive tradition. What he actually knew of rabbinic interpretation and how he knew it has still not been resolved satisfactorily, although we do know some things. From early to mid-career, Luther's primary conduit into rabbinic learning, essentially Rashi, was the biblical commentaries of Nicholas of Lyra, as well as the additions to Lyra by the Jewish convert Paul of Bourgogne. In late career, Luther had access to Sebastian Münster's diglot Hebrew-Latin Bible with annotations, a work of immense learning that drew on numerous medieval Jewish commentators not well represented in Lyra or Bourgogne. And though the Wittenberg translation team had available to it a copy of the famous Second Rabbinic Bible of 1525, we know there was a copy of this great Bible in Wittenberg in the library, there could be no question of Luther reading Hebrew and Aramaic rabbinic texts for himself in systematic fashion. We can talk more about this later if you were at all interested in it. Luther's own firsthand engagement with this literature was selective at the very best. But be that as it may, Luther was convinced that he knew more than enough about rabbinic interpretation, and over the course of his career, he developed a visceral antipathy toward the rabbis. Already by the mid-1520s, he had concluded the rabbis were the central instruments of the ongoing Jewish resistance to the gospel. And in his magnum opus, his lectures on Genesis over the last 10 years of his life, these lectures are saturated, literally saturated, with anti-rabbinic polemic. His most consistent critique of the rabbis is that while they can be helpful to Christians in matters of Hebrew grammar, they know nothing of theology. That is the subject matter of the text. I have a quote from Luther that I'll spare you of the time being. Now for Luther, the strict corollary of such anti-rabbinic polemic is the folly of Christian interpreters who allow themselves to be influenced theologically by the rabbis. The 16th century was the age of the birth of a movement called Christian Hebraism. That intellectual movement within Christianity that sought and eventually gained expertise not only in biblical Hebrew, but also in the Hebrew and Aramaic of classic rabbinic sources, and in their systems of thought, as well as in the great Jewish medieval commentators. Now, Luther's scholarly career spanned the beginnings of this movement, and he himself benefited from it, and one could say to a limited extent contributed to it. But when it came to matters of theology, Luther adopted a rigidly antagonistic stance. In his infamous anti-Jewish treatise from March of 1543 called On the Ineffable Name, he makes his position crystal clear with respect to the rabbis. I'm going to quote you, give you this quote, and then we're basically done. Here's Luther. on pain of losing divine grace and eternal life. It is forbidden for us Christians to believe or regard as right the scriptural interpretations and glosses of the rabbis. We are, however, permitted to read them in order to see what kind of damned devil's work they're up to, and so protect ourselves from it. For thus says Moses in Deuteronomy 28, God will strike you with madness, blindness, and frenzy of heart. Moses did not say this about the cursed Goyim, but rather about his own circumcised saints, the noble blood, the princes of heaven and earth, who call themselves Israel. Thereby, all of their interpretations, glosses, and exegesis of Scripture are damned by God himself as nothing more than pure madness, blindness, and frenzy. God himself regards and judges all of their labor over Scripture in these past 1,500 years as not only false and lies, but also pure blindness and a frenzied, mad thing. This is the true conclusion, I promise you. 6 years earlier, prior to that quote, in February of 1537, while on a trip to the town of Schmalkalv, Luther was ill with a terrible bout of kidney stones. I mean, it's a medical problem that he had for most of his adult life, a horrific, horrific problem. He was terribly ill with kidney stones, this time, in fact, so ill that he thought he was dying, and he almost did. And I should say that this happening in 1537, both history and our question that we're discussing today would be different had he died in 1537 and not written what he wrote in 1538 and then in 1543 and 44. He almost died. And among the several statements that were recorded at his bedside, one reveals something vital about Luther's own self-understanding. It's a quote that just jumped out of me during some research last summer. Luther said, thinking he's on his deathbed, he says, "I will be and I will die an enemy of all the enemies of my Christ. I will be and I will die an enemy of all the enemies of my Christ." The 1543 statement that I quoted for you just prior, I think, demonstrates that not only the rabbis, but also those Christian interpreters who follow them in matters theological, are high on the list of those regarded by Luther as the enemies of my Christ. And I'm going to put a period on it and stop there. I think that's more than enough. And hopefully a few things came up that we'll have opportunity to have some good conversation after we take a break.
Thank you. Yeah.
I think. Do you want a break?
It's up to you folks. It's up to y'all.
Yeah, if we could just. I know some people have to leave a bit early. Why don't we take a 2-minute break, and reconvene? In 2 or 3 minutes. Thank you so much, Brooke. And see you later. Okay. Thanks, Martin. 6:15. Bye bye.
Is that a love to see the text? I can just
I've been to instinctively some of these considerations in my writing bona fide author, but this really gives me a clarity and focus that I would really like to use at this point.
These are excerpts from Harry Peter's first portion of our
introduction. That is the finest treatment of that I've ever heard. Okay, I'm going to be back in a second. Okay.
Many people have tried to talk about Luther as, in some respect, a forerunner of modern critical interpretation, you know, which has been so interested in recovering the original historical sense of text and so forth. Yes and no, and probably more no in that regard. But for Luther, the issue of a text theological meaning, you know, the legitimate theological sense of a text, that's something pretty well new with him, I would say. You know, and you know, it influenced Protestant interpretation in many ways, certainly for many years. One of the big differences between, you could say, the Lutheran tradition, the Lutheran stream, and the Calvinist stream, you know, comes down to this issue of how you understand the nature of the Old Testament itself. And Calvin, you know, Calvin and Calvinists as a rule didn't feel the need to what we moderns would say, Christianize the Old Testament. The Calvinist tradition tended to see things more in developmental, you know, evolutionary terms, you know, where the New Testament Christianity comes as a complement and a fulfillment and so on and so forth. But Luther, you know, Luther, when I said that for him the Old Testament was a Christian book, he really genuinely believes that. And this is important because there are different ways of being vehemently anti-Jewish. Luther's way is one way of doing that. The most popular ancient way of doing it in the second and third centuries was the Marcionite way. And so you have to understand that there are different kinds of anti-Judaism where the Bible is concerned and where biblical interpretation is concerned. And Luther and Marcion are as far apart as it is possible to be. They're as far apart as it's possible to be. And they're both vehemently anti-Jewish, but for very different reasons. No. Helpful?
Yeah.
Yep.
So you briefly mentioned Romans 11 earlier.
Yes.
And I was trying to figure out, can you explain more about how Luther was able to get around Paul's sort of explicit words in Romans 11, like 11:25, where he just simply says, all Israel will be saved.
Yes.
So how did he deal with that?
Well, it's the more you study the passage, the more elusive you'll see it becomes, and particularly when you read it in the original language. Mm-hmm. Because the question becomes, and it's still debated, I mean, the big gun New Testament people are still fighting about this, and the question is, what does he mean by Israel at that point? Mm-hmm. What does he mean by Israel? And does Paul mean by Israel, Israel katazarka, Israel according to the flesh, i.e. the Jews, or does he mean Israel as he uses it in Galatians, in the sense of the Israel of God, which includes both Jews and Christians. And so there are different ways to read that passage, and I think legitimate ways to read it. But Luther, you know, he was always suspicious of that. And you know, his wrestling with that passage over the course of his career is fascinating in itself, because as I think I mentioned, you know, he comes to the point where he completely rejects the notion of the grand mass conversion of Judaism to Christianity in the eschaton, which was a broadly held conviction in the church, and was used, obviously, you could see the payoff for that, used as a reason, you know, to tolerate Jewish communities, Jewish people, tolerate synagogues, and so forth, because, you know, Christians had the expectation that they would eventually convert.
Yeah. So you talked about Luther focuses with his hatred and arguments against some of the Jews in this comment up with biblical Jews. Nothing in the argument with both the arguments are great if you can see that. It also seems that at a certain point he goes on this long look against circumcision in different types of works. And so I wonder, do you see like parallels between his beliefs against the Jews and against the Catholics in this idea of sort of works rather than faith as
absolutely
salvation? And,
yeah.
And are those sort of grounded in sort of the same thing? And then does that reach back to sort of, you know, biblical Judaism also?
Yes, sort of yes to all of that. Luther believed that Catholicism, or at least as promulgated by the current popes, was sort of the newfangled Judaism. Yeah, sort of Judaism of a either higher or lower order, depending on what perspective you're coming from. But he thought it was a work. Catholicism is a works righteous religion, and Judaism is the quintessential example of a works righteous religion. The problem you get into when you start studying Reformation polemics is that the worst thing you could call anyone was a Jew. Right? And we know how there are things that work in American culture about what in certain towns or in certain states or in certain areas, what's the worst thing you can call someone. And in the Reformation, calling someone a Jew, that's the worst you can call someone. And so Luther called the Catholics Jews, and the Catholics called Luther a Jew. And that there were many Roman Catholic treatises, titled, Lutheranism, the New Judaism, stuff like that. And so it was a throw around term, and nobody wanted that label. And that was the big issue. I mentioned to you the emergence of the movement called Christian Hebraism. That was a big, big issue among these Christian scholars who were beginning to study Semitic texts, Hebrew and Aramaic texts, very, very seriously, and to get really good at it. Because the problem always was, and it had been throughout Christian history, although Semitic texts were not studied that much, except for a few pockets, the problem has always been for a Christian who's deeply immersed in the Hebrew language, and to a certain extent Aramaic, is that it raises the suspicion on the part of church superiors that you are some kind of closet Jew or Jewish sympathizer or something else. And one of the great painful ironies of this whole intellectual movement called Christian Hebraism is that every single one of the big gun Christian Hebraists, and some that were very good, every single one of them would write a scathing anti-Jewish treatise. Every single one of them. And they did it, to defend themselves against the accusation. You know so much Hebrew, you must be a closet Jew. You must have been a Jew in hiding all along, or you're a Jewish sympathizer, or you're about to convert, or all these things. Mm-hmm. But every single one of them wrote scathing anti-Jewish treatises.
So then would you see some of the repudiation of Judaism based in biblical Judaism? Would some of the theme of works or works righteousness be something that sort of crosses over that rupture?
Oh yeah, he sees. Yeah, that's there from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And that's the Old Testament is not all good for Luther. There's good and bad, right? And in the faith portion, the faith of the patriarchs and matriarchs, and the trust in the promise of the coming Messiah, and in that alone, mm-hmm. this is what he raises up and what he celebrates and so on and so forth. But any kind of move that any of the characters in the stories make that want to claim something for themselves before God, and circumcision, of course, becomes the big one for him, that becomes the example of works righteousness or a related term for him boasting in the flesh, which I mentioned earlier. And so the battle, the battle that he's fighting with Rome, I mean, Luther saw himself as basically equivalent to one of the biblical prophets. Luther in his day, in other words, he was fighting the same battle. The prophets were fighting against works righteousness. They were fighting against boasting in the flesh. They were calling Israel to task for this, that, or the other thing. And Luther sees his role in his own context very, very similarly. Excellent. Thanks.
Yeah, kind of going off of the idea we were talking about before, we're saying that Luther's anti-Jewish Judaism is more physically motivated than culturally.
Yeah.
So looking back on the reading we did on the Jews in Their Lives,
yes.
There's this whole section where he talks about how to respond to his sincere advice,
yes.
how to handle the Jews, and he's saying things like set fire to the synagogues or schools, burn, cover them with dirt. So I was wondering if you could maybe explain how we would have seen that as a biblical response, or if that would be more culturally motivated.
Yeah. Understand that this is 1543. This is end game. I mean, this is the end of a long development. It's at the point where he's completely given up any hopes of mass Jewish conversion. But also what has happened leading up to the fateful year of 1543, also what has happened is that he has come into possession of what is for him new knowledge. There was a treatise written by this Jewish convert named Antonius Margarita. And by the way, you should know that two of the most famous anti-Jewish writers in Christian history are named Margarita and Martini. That's actually true. But Antonius Margarita came from a well-to-do and famous rabbinic family. And he converted to Christianity. He became, from studying Isaiah, he came to be convinced that the Christian message and Christian interpretation of certain passages was correct. And he converted. But what he also did was begin to translate portions of the Jewish liturgy as well as descriptions of Jewish ritual practice, you know, Yom Kippur, circumcision, so on and so forth, and translated all this into German, where people like Luther could read it, you know, and begin to understand it. And what he discovered via Margarita's translations was that Jews said in synagogue some really bad things about Jesus and his mother. No? And Luther was a medieval man in many respects. And Luther's reverence of the Blessed Virgin was off the scales. He revered her because Mary represented for Luther the perfect example of faith. You know, the handmaiden of the Lord, here I am, let it be to me according to your word. This is the perfect example. But his reverence for Mary was off the scales. And the idea that somebody, a Jew, could call Mary names, which medieval Jews did, just profoundly affected him. Profoundly. Medieval Jews made puns out of Christian names. For example, Maria, Hebrew Maria, Jews would say, instead of saying Maria, they would say Haria. Instead of saying Maria, they would say Haria. And Haria is an Aramaic word that means basically shithouse. And Luther translates it into German as Scheißhaus. Into German as Scheißhaus. This is what they say. You know, and in the word plays on Jesus' name, calling him Yeshu and so forth. From Luther's perspective, this represented blasphemy. This is blasphemy. And blasphemy is an unforgivable offense for Luther and for most Christians in those days. It's an unforgivable offense. And so what happens then, you start to connect these dots, and then according to Luther's logic, now that I have knowledge of what these Jews are doing every Saturday in their synagogues, now that I know what's going on in their synagogue, even though there are no synagogues, you know, in Wittenberg, there are none, you know, but it's another subject we can talk about. Mm-hmm. But now that I have knowledge of what they're actually doing, that in synagogues they are blaspheming Jesus and his mother, we Christians cannot in good conscience tolerate their presence, because if we do, we are implicated in their blasphemy. If you are knowledgeable of blasphemy and you tolerate it, you are implicated in that very blasphemy. And when you go back and read the treatise and its proposals, you can see that's what's driving it. And the proposals themselves, I might say, there are two things going on in this horrible treatise. It is a horrible treatise, really. The only thing that Luther doesn't do in the treatise, of course, is advocate the murder of Jews. He does not do that, to his credit. Although there is an allusion in the treatise where he says, where he's addressing the authorities and says, you know, if you don't do your jobs, I can't guarantee you that some good Germans might not just take matters into their own hands. You know, he's got that kind of brown shirt, you know, stuff, to use a gross anachronism. There are two things going on there. One, he's come to the conviction that Christians can no longer tolerate Jews because of their blasphemy. The best result, the best solution to this problem is that Jews should be forced to live where there are no Christians. And he says it in the treatise. Jews should be forced to live where there are no Christians. Because if there are no Christians around, then Christians cannot be implicated in their blasphemy. That's his preferred solution, expulsion. Right? That's the preferred solution. The proposals come if the governing authorities do not want to expel the Jews. If his duke does not want to expel the Jews, then he advocates, if you're going to tolerate them, then we're going to tolerate them under these conditions. Now you go back and read those proposals again and try to envision yourself as a Jew living under those circumstances. And what do you realize? What the proposals do to you? They destroy the substructure of your religious, social, and cultural life. Now, why would he argue such a thing? Well, if the authorities won't act to expel the Jews, if these measures are implemented, the Jews themselves will leave willingly. They'll leave willingly. Now, so far as we know, none of those measures that he proposes in this horrific treatise were ever implemented. The burning of the synagogues, of course. You know, Kristallnacht, you'll probably talk about that this semester, happened on Luther's birthday. And Luther was invoked.
Which a Christian claimed to be completing the work of Luther.
Yep. There's something to the effect, you know, this night synagogues of Germany are burning and Martin Luther is applauding with us, or Dr. Martin Luther is applauding with us, or some such thing.
Can I just ask one little small point here? This story of Mary, of the blasphemous kind of used her for name.
Yeah,
where did Luther hear this?
This is from. These are coming. There are three different avenues here. One is Antonius Margaritas' treatise,
mm-hmm.
Der ganz Jüdisch Glaub.
Okay.
It was published in 1530 and second edition 1531. We know that Luther had his own copy.
Okay.
I think we even have Luther's marginalia are still extant from the copy of this document. He mentions it in the table talks and so forth.
Okay.
So we've got that. The other are things he learned via the work of Sebastian Münster, mm-hmm. this great Christian Hebraist. And Münster was a conduit for Luther, but not until 1535 or so.
Yeah.
So relatively late. He gets access to this work of Münster. And Münster knows about the Toldot Yeshu, this collection of Jewish anti-Jesus satire from the late Middle Ages. Münster knows about this and writes about it, and Luther gets access to it that way. Münster also knows about another Jewish document called Sefer Nitzachon Vetus, the Old Book of Victory, that probably is a 15th century, 14th, 15th century document of German Judaism, which is essentially a collection of all Jewish arguments against Christianity, you know, defensive arguments against Christianity. And some of them are, you know, really scatological, you know, funny, angry, you know, all these types of things. And so Luther gets access to that as well through almost for sure. For sure through Münster, but he didn't know it before. And I think it is not coincidental that the 1538 treatise against the Sabbatarians and then the three things from 1543 are all on the heels of his, you know, coming into possession of this new knowledge of which he was not aware before.
Thank you.
Yes.
There's a section in On the Jews and Their Lives where Luther speaks very harshly against Jews as being prideful and boastful
mm-hmm.
of their rights at the shows of people. I was wondering how Luther reconciled that argument with his own feeling of being being like sort of a new prophet or a speaker of new God.
Yeah. It's a great point. Luther is a man of many contradictions. Mm-hmm. He's a man of many contradictions. He hated pride, but he knew also that it was one of his own vices. And we're reading with the benefit of hindsight. We read from a different context, a different dialogical context, and so forth. But Luther, the pomposity of the way in which he writes against the Jews is really stunning to me. There's a pomposity to it. That, you know, if you know a little bit about traditional Judaism, if you know a little bit, it's just nauseating, really. And it's why I used the language before that it's imperative for contemporary Christians to have some real sensibility of how Luther sounds to Jewish ears, you know. Mm. And if one of the reasons that my spouse and I are putting this book together is because most Jews know more about what Luther said about Jews than Lutherans do, you know. Jews know the name of Martin Luther, not because of the 95 Theses. They know the name of Martin Luther. So, good point.
Can I ask to that point, sort of the contemporary wrestlings with this, and I asked you about the Judenzell plaque and the conversation around that.
What is that?
The... she's referring to this figure that is known as the in German as the Judenzau, the Jewish sow. It's a figure known in medieval art throughout Europe, especially in Germany and in France. And they were in different sizes and different configurations of what's actually going on in these figures. The famous one, still remaining in Germany, is on the very church where Luther preached most of his sermons, the city church in Wittenberg, and it's on the exterior wall of the church. It's not on the inside. Many of these figures were on the inside of Christian churches and cathedrals. The one in Wittenberg is on the outside. It's on the southeast corner of the outside of the church, and it's high above the ground. And it's not large, you know. It's like this type of size, what we're talking about, and it's high above the ground, and so it's not something that you would automatically notice. I learned a couple of summers ago in Germany, talking to an expert about this topic, about the strategic significance of the location on the southeast corner of the church. It's because it symbolizes it's in the direction of Jerusalem, so that's why it's there. And the one in Jerusalem has, you know, a large sow, and underneath the sow there are piglets and young Jews who are sucking underneath the sow, and then behind the sow there's a rabbi, a Jewish male, who's lifting the tail of the sow and kind of sticking his nose, you know, into her rump. Okay. Now Luther, This was a common Christian anti-Jewish motif in medieval Christian Europe because of what the pig represented and so on and so forth. Luther wrote a treatise called On the Ineffable Name in 1543, 2 months after he had written the treatise on the lies. And he has a long excursus on the Judenzau in Wittenberg. And he's very proud of it. He says, he draws attention to this figure, and he's very proud of it, and he describes it in intimate detail. Now, he'd never been up on a scaffold, as far as I know. I mean, he had stood beneath this thing and looked high up on the wall and studied it. And he goes on at length about what it represents. And the point that Luther makes is, why is the rabbi looking into the sow's butt? What's he doing? And according to Luther, he's looking into the sow's butt because that's where the rabbis discover the Talmud. That's where the Talmud comes up. The Talmud comes out of the ass of the sow. Luther says it in German. That's where it comes from. And it's in a context in which he's boasting. Look at this wonderful sandstone relief that we have on our church. You know, it's one of our great claims to fame in Little Wittenberg. You mentioned also that there's now a plaque on the ground right beneath this. Have any of you been to Wittenberg by chance? When were you there?
3 years ago.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about here, then.
Which one? What do you ask?
The Judensaal. Did you get to see
it? I went to the church, but I didn't really see it.
Okay. If you would go there today, there's now a plaque in the ground directly beneath the Judensaal. It was placed there out of a collaboration between the current worshiping community of that church and the German Jewish community of that area. And they put a plaque there, which in German is called a Mahnung, a warning, that is one of the most haunting things you'll ever see in your life when you put together the inscription that's been placed around this plaque. Because the treatise that Luther wrote on the ineffable name is a reference to the Tetragrammaton, the four-letter name of God. And Luther spends half of this treatise making fun of Jewish reverence for the personal name of God. Yeah. The Jewish term for the Tetragrammaton, the four-letter name, is Shem HaMephoras, the fully articulated name of God, or the... And Luther turns that Hebrew phrase around by changing the vowel points. He says, the rabbis like to change vowel points, so I'm going to change vowel points. And I'm going to change the word Shem HaMephoras, in Hebrew, Shem HaMephorash. I'm going to change that word into Sham HaPeresh. Sham HaPeresh. Which, if you know Hebrew, you can do. You simply change the vowel points and you create a different term. And so, what Luther does is to change the term, the ineffable name of God, into, in Hebrew, there's the shit. He says, that's what they're really saying. Sham HaPeresh, there's the shit. And he's doing this, you know, out of great pride and boasting. So what the contemporary communities have done in placing this warning down below, they've created, there's an image that looks like, it's in the image of a cross, and it looks like that beneath the, where you can see, beneath where you can see the sign of the cross, it looks like there's like molten lava underneath it about to bubble out. And then there's an inscription in German around the whole warning that says, I wish I could call it from memory, the ineffable name of God, which Jews for many centuries prior to the rise of Christianity regarded as unspeakably holy, died in the hearts of 6 million Jews. Died in the hearts of 6 million Jews. And this is what the German Christian Lutheran community of that town has put there. And that's what it says. And then there's a Hebrew inscription on two sides, Mimamachim Karatika Adonai, the first line of Psalm 130, out of the depths I cry to you, O Lord, which, ironically, is the title of one of Luther's greatest hymns. Aus Tiefer Not, which he loved. So yeah, that's a hot one.
I was just going to ask about...
My
quick question. So in emphasizing anti-Judaism rather than subject, this is a theological brotherhood. Where does that leave you as far as
this is a very important issue, and what you call this, what do you call it, and should it be called anti-Semitism or is it better to call it anti-Judaism? Is a very important question. In one sense, calling Luther anti-Semitic is anachronistic. Because you may know that the term anti-Semitism wasn't even coined until the late 19th century. It was coined in Germany, and, ironically, the term was intended as a positive. In other words, the dude that coined the term was arguing that it's a good thing to be anti-Semitic. It's a good thing that good Germans should be anti-Semitic. So you have that whole issue. Luther was not a late 19th century, 20th century racist. His writings, he doesn't go that direction naturally. Although there are a couple of problematic things in his text that raise that question. So I think there's value in referring to Luther as anti-Jewish rather than anti-Semitic to try to at least bracket certain questions. And after a long conversation, my wife and I decided that's the term we'd use throughout the book whenever it comes up. Having said that, it's not a neat and tidy title either. An American Jewish scholar writing on Luther and the Jews warns about Christians too easily bracketing anti-Semitism off and, you know, not being willing to apply that category to certain figures from church history because of the subtle way in which it can communicate the claim that anti-Semitism really has nothing to do with theology. And that's one should be very, very careful of. You know, much of anti-Semitism and much of these thugs, you know, in Germany, you know, didn't even know what the word theology was. But there were a lot of smart people, theologians, mm-hmm. who did know what the word was, you know. And this has always been the case. Mm-hmm. So I'm sorry that I'm not able to be more precise on this one, other than to say your question is a very important one, and this is a conversation that's going to continue to go on.
Yeah, I'm kind of trying to explore, I guess, a little bit how the two texts that Jesus.
Jesus Christ was born a Jew.
And then the other one. I kind of wondered more about Luther's Christology in terms of how he, I mean, he acknowledges that Christ is ethnically a Jew, and
yes.
that eternally so, and how did that, that seems, I mean, that's just obvious, it's a huge claim to say Christ is eternally the God-man Jewish.
Yeah.
But then that doesn't seem to necessarily maybe hold the ground across with hope of what.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I couldn't say it any better. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And you could say that the seeds of a different way of thinking about these topics in Luther's own thinking are there. But they did not sprout. They did not sprout. But they sprouted in others, you know, and they sprouted, you know, in most thinking Christian circles today. You know, the acknowledgement of the Jewishness of Jesus, and people are still trying to come to terms with what that can mean, but not in Luther.
Coming back.
You talked about how Luther always held these anti-Jewish views, but they kind of intensified at different points in his life. And looking at the first section, Jesus Christ was born a Jew, he seems very intent on, you know, working to convert the Jews.
Yes.
And even Frederick would say that we should deal with the Jews in a fatherly fashion.
Yes.
But I just think like a big transformation to me from there to the second passage was talking about you know, certain synagogues and all these
things.
I was wondering if you could just speak a little more on that transformation.
Yes. And clearly there's a difference. There's no question about that. I'm not saying that Luther said the same things about Jews always. Clearly there's a difference in this regard. But the thing you can't underestimate about that treatise, the 1523 treatise, is the rhetorical background of the treatise. Who is Luther arguing against in this treatise? He's arguing against Rome. And what is he arguing about? He's arguing about the way in which Catholicism traditionally had converted Jews, which was essentially through baptism and often forced baptism, and simply leaving it at that. Once you recognize that and you go back and read the treatise, you begin to see that what he's really attacking there is what is, from his perspective, a failure of catechesis on the part of the Roman Church. And he's saying the reason why Jews have not converted to Christianity is because Rome has screwed everything up. You can see how it fits his... And remember, this is just 3 years after his excommunication.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Rome has screwed everything up. And now that we have once again rediscovered the gospel in its pure form, in the way it's supposed to be proclaimed, in the way it was originally proclaimed before the papacy screwed it all up, if we can just share this message with the Jews in a kindly, brotherly manner, they'll be able to see it. And once they begin to see the truth of the gospel, then we can continue to teach them, to catechize them, to educate them in ways that the Roman Church has, failed so miserably. So he's got that. That's the angle that's going on there. But it's consistent with what I said earlier in one regard. Treat them kindly in the hopes of their conversion. Treat them kindly in the hopes of their conversion. Not treat them kindly so that they can continue to practice their Judaism. And that's the way Jews read the treatise. The Jews of Germany, this treatise was one of the most popular things that Luther ever published. I mean, it was reprinted 28 times or some such thing. And the German Jews were very excited about this treatise. Because what did it signal for them? It signaled for them, hey, maybe Luther's Reformation is something to get behind and support. Because the Reformation might mean tolerance. It might mean religious tolerance. And so they were very excited by this. No intentions of converting Christianity, but they were very, very excited about this prospect. But, when Luther began to realize that the Jews had taken his kind overture as an excuse to continue practicing Judaism, he explodes. He blows up. And he says it in the Treatise on the Lies. Since it's come to my attention that you have, you've used my kindness as an excuse to continue being Jews, you've completely misconstrued what I intended by that. Yeah, that's where the biblical interpretation piece comes into play there. And one of the texts that we are excerpting in the book has to do with a meeting that happened probably in 1526 between Luther and three learned Jews. And Luther engaged these three learned Jews in an exegetical debate about the interpretation of Jeremiah 23. And Luther, apparently, from all that we can gather, was simply stunned by the fact that the rabbis were not persuaded by his arguments. That he was stunned by it. And I think that's the point. From that point on, he begins to write against the rabbis, write against the Talmud, rabbinic interpretation, and so on and so forth. And he never really looks back. And that's 1526. That's early on, first 10 years of the Reformation, and he's already completely sour. Or anyone has to talk here in a minute.
This is kind of on a completely different note, but I am from Alabama and I grew up Presbyterian, and I've always heard of Luther in like solely positive light. And I was wondering if you have anything to say about maybe we just don't talk about this side of Luther's beliefs or writings, or if people don't know about it, or just like, because I feel like I've read a fair amount of theology, and I feel like I've heard a lot about Luther and I've never heard anything negative.
Yeah. Well, there's plenty. there's plenty of negative in Luther. It's one of the great, one of the things that makes him, I think, a great figure. And of course, a problem that complicates Luther vis-a-vis other of his contemporaries and most great Christian thinkers preceding him is that we know so damn much about Luther. The guy, you know, basically had not an unpublished thought. We know so much about him, and not just what he thought, but we know a lot about his interiority, which he wrote about. And you can write volumes about the interior life of Martin Luther. Eric Erickson can do a psychological analysis of Luther and his father, or attempt to do it. We know so much about him because of what he himself said and what he revealed about himself and his own struggles. Now, you try to write a volume on the interiority of John Calvin, mm-hmm. and you have nothing to write. There's nothing to write. We know about Luther's bowels. Luther writes to his wife. He writes to his wife about his bowel movements. He writes about the type of beer that encourages more bowel movements. We know so much about him. I'm a Lutheran pastor, professor at Lutheran Seminary. I'm proud to be a Lutheran. I'm proud to call myself by Luther's name. In this area, I'm not. I'm horrified by it. And the solution is not to hide from it. The solution is to bring it out. I mean, he wrote about it. Bring it out. And German Lutheran Christians have done a lot more work, hard, soulful work, mm-hmm. on this issue than have American Christians. They've had to, you know. They've had to.
Did you ever hear about the fear of the bowel movements? And
no, I've
never heard that either. That's the Luther I love.
Yeah, he loves scatological, you know. I mean, he was a great polemicist. You know, he's not the type of guy you want to get in an argument with, but he's going to beat you, you know. He's a genius of the German language, word plays. Even if you don't know German, you can pick up this one. Kaspar Schwenkfeld was one of Luther's Reformation opponents, Kaspar Schwenkfeld, and Luther always referred to him as Dr. Stinkfeld. And stink in German means the same thing it does in English. Dr. Stinkfeld. His writings are, you know, full of this type of stuff. But one of the reasons why the scatological imagery was big in the Middle Ages, because scatological stuff was associated with the devil. The devil is most closely associated with feces. And so when you hurl scatological references at your opponents, it's a way of putting them in camp with the devil. It's something that's normally missed by modern people when they read this stuff. And Luther was a master of it.
How widespread were the thoughts that Jewish people were both taking everyone's money and also secretly wanting to kill everyone?
Yeah.
I mean, there's the theological side to things.
Yeah.
But then that pops up substantially as well, this idea that the Jews are living lazily off everyone else's work.
Yeah.
Impoverishing everyone else.
Yeah.
And would, if they had the chance, kill each other.
Yeah, the Jews get accused of everything. There's nowhere to hide. They can turn the page. They can be accused of being rich and taking all our money, and on the other hand, being uneducated, stupid, and stink. You know, it's both ends of the spectrum. It depends on what the issue at stake is. Luther, as a rule, did not. When he's arguing about Jews, he's never talking directly to Jews. He didn't write treatises to Jews. He wrote treatises to Christians against Jews and about Jews. But as a rule, he did not, the post-desecration, ritual murder, all of those types of things, which were so very common in the Middle Ages. Luther did not, it's one of the places where he stands out, you know, against his forebears. He didn't go there, except in the treatise on the laws. And I think that, I don't even know if he believed it. He's just, in the lies, he is doing everything he possibly can to get the Jews out of Germany. Mm.
Is that tied to a genuine concern, you think, that they were threatening other folks' salvation, and on Judgment Day, there could be folks who consider themselves Christians who would be damned
sure.
if they had allowed?
You bet.
Yeah.
You bet. That never underestimate that. And this whole antagonism toward Christian use of Jewish interpretation is that right? You're right on target with that. Yeah. Don't you realize what you're doing? You know, when you play that game. And the threat of the final judgment is always there. It's not a hypothetical. It's not something you sit around and discuss pro or con. It was very, very real for him.
You mentioned earlier that the Old Testament, Luther had it as, in essence, the same faith as the New Testament, and how
same faith,
and,
yes,
and how the Old Testament faith is actually superior to the New Testament faith, yeah. And yet Luther is able to, or he would poke fun at the Tetragrammaton, or you know, he switch around the letters and desecrate that name the way that they did.
Yeah.
The name of Mary. And I guess I wonder how he didn't see that as also blaspheming the God of the New Testament, or the God of the workers of all of CC. And is he counting that as the wrong interpretation, the way that they view the Tetragrammaton? And
yes.
Is he putting that under, you know, he mentions in the Jews in their lives how they end up defiling their own practices or their own the promises that God has given them, such as circumcision, and they end up contorting that into something that it is blasphemous. So does he see the way that they regard Hashem in the same way?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I mean, he is really playing with fire, even on his own terms, when he goes off here in this area. What he's really after, he's after a particular type of medieval rabbinic exegesis at this point. And the type of exegesis was shared by both Jews and Christians in the Middle Ages. It's a practice called gematria. And that has to do with assigning numerical equivalents to the letters of the alphabet. Right? All Hebrew letters have a numerical equivalent. And so that means that if each letter of the Hebrew alphabet has a numerical equivalent, then also each word in the Bible has its own numerical equivalent. And so in the Middle Ages, people would, you know, search the text for words that were utterly unrelated contextually, but which have the same numerical equivalents. And then they would make lots of interpretive hay out of that. And Luther thought it was all completely superstition and crazy. And much of this was, and some of this was done with the name of God as well. And so what he's satirizing in this particular treatise is that exegetical practice. But the tool that he's using to satirize is, as you correctly identified, the name of God. And man, he's doing some stuff there. And it's obscene, really. It's truly obscene. And he regards Jewish reverence for the Tetragrammaton, saying things like Hashem and so forth, as superstition and hyperpiety and things like that. So it all becomes a big joke. So it's an excellent question.
Let's make this the last question. I think we could go on for quite some time. And Brooks, thanks again for this.
Well, thanks for your question.
Mind blowing.
So you actually listened to what I said. I was really worried about that.
No. But Chris is patiently waited for a follow-up.
Yeah, well, it was actually a follow-up to a question about 30 minutes ago. when you're talking about the calling to sort of expel the Jews from Christian areas to separate them. And so this sort of betrays my lack of reformation in local history. But I was struck in your response to that question and reading the thing, how quickly it seems that Lutheran Reformation started this sort of, you know, rebellion against the Catholic Church, this minority movement, how quickly it goes to instead of being in charge. Because you talk about his reason for wanting to expel them maybe had a little bit to do with sort of purity, you know, they're implicated in, you know, the blasphemy. There's also, you know, in allowing the blasphemy, you know, we're implicated. So it's sort of this idea of punishment or whatever also. So how quickly it goes from this, and so in a span of like 30 years, it seems, from this minority thing to this sort of Constantinian responsibility to try to sort of properly order society.
In you bet.
And how does that happen so rapidly?
It just does. It just does. Because, I mean, this is the birth of Germany in many respects. You know, and these Protestant princes were consolidating power.
I say, was the sort of political situation solidified in a way by the 40s that he could sort of
the mid-1550s, shortly after his death, Peace of Augsburg. It was really, that was the first time that Lutherans were ever officially recognized as legit.
So even before they were recognized as legit, he's still saying he is sort of Lutheran Christian.
And remember as well that the European countries to the west had solved this problem many years before. I mean, England is first, you know, in France and Spain. The European Jewish population had been moving east, you know, for many centuries prior to Luther. And then you have, you know, Spain, the most recent, 1492. You know, I was a history and German major in college. I went to a Lutheran seminary. I had to go to the University of Chicago Divinity School before I ever learned that something happened in 1492 other than that Columbus sailed the ocean blue. That's when I learned it. But you ask any Jew what 1492 means, and they tell you in Hebrew. So the Jewish population had been moving steadily east, and Germany was dealing with problems that the countries to the west no longer had on their hands. And the occasion leading up to the Treatise on the Lies that you mentioned earlier, just a couple of years in the early 1540s, Prague, which was a major Jewish population center, expelled its Jewish community. And many of those Prague Jews had to find a place to live, and they were, you know, and Saxony is not far from Prague, folks. They're very, very close. So many of those Prague Jews were making their way back into Saxony. And so the question of whether Saxony and other Protestant lands should tolerate Jews was a real question. It wasn't a hypothetical, it was a real question. And Luther is, you know, constantly pushing John Frederick. No, they can't live here. They can't live here.
Can I just ask one final quick follow-up?
You're the boss.
Sorry, because nothing. I'm really not. But I just want to be clear. So by the, you know, by the 1540s and the second treatise we read today, you noted that Luther had given up hope in the conversion of Jews. But had he also given up the possibility, or the theological possibility, of Jewish conversion to Christianity? Had that ceased to become a theological possibility? And I ask this because, you know, after 1933, with the passage of the Arian laws, Jewish Christians, of course, were subject to the same scrutiny and prohibitions as Jews, on the grounds that, you know, these unyielding kind of racial ontologies made impossible, you know, the conversion of a Jew to Christianity.
Yes.
It was this kind of essential Jewishness that could never be in any way transformed.
That's an excellent question. I would say two things. One, the Luther clearly had given up hope of any kind of mass conversion.
Mm-hmm.
he always believed that there would always be some. And he would say, there will always be some, however few. There will always be Christians, however few, among the seed of Abraham. And that, you know, he holds to. But it's an occasional thing for him, not looking to some sort of mass conversion. On the other hand, the one positive in Luther, at least from a Christian perspective around this issue, and what makes Luther so different from, I think, from Rome, mm-hmm. But also from Erasmus, mm-hmm. is that Luther always argued that if a Jew genuinely converts to Christianity, you know, out of a good heart, not seeking to dupe somebody or to escape persecution or whatever, but if a Jew genuinely converts to Christianity, Luther accepts that convert as a true, full Christian. Now, that may strike you as, well, what's the big deal? It's an utter aberration in his day. It's an utter aberration. Erasmus, you know, the great humanist, the greatest scholar of the 16th century, Erasmus would just come out and say, a baptized Jew will never become a proper Christian. It's an ontological issue. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Will never become. Yeah. Erasmus, as brilliant as he was, had his own virulent Judenhass. Patron of Jews.
Thank you so much.
Thank you all of you.
So I'm just going to take about 10 minutes to just sort of pass the syllabus out. If you'd like, you can just
sit outside
or go to Starbucks. Or
what about we're going to go to supper in a little while, right?
We're going to go to supper in. We need to be leaving here.
Can I just take my stuff with me to supper?
Absolutely, right? Just put it in the back of my car.
Okay, cool.
With all the beer bottles and other things. My car's right out here, so we can easily do that.
He really does have a beer bottle in his back seat.
I know, but it's German. It's a long story, please.
Yeah. All right.
All right.
Thank you all for your questions.
Thank you.
And your patience. Yeah. This has been very rich for me.
And again, when can we anticipate this book?
It'll be out in the summer.
Okay.
It'll be out in the summer. Fortress Press, yeah.
Well, we look forward to having you back.
I'd love to do it.
Yeah.
I'd love to do it. I'm a big fan of Mr. Jefferson.
Yeah, well.
We'll put it well around here.
That's right.
That is how he's called here, right?
Yeah, that's right. Very well, sir. Very well done. I don't think I've ever called him that.
Okay. I think I have to be like,
I don't know. But he's still, people still use
that. Mr. Jefferson University.
Hello, sir. Professor? Doctor?
You're fashionably late.
That's right.
I'm taking all the way apart. I'm going
to
go.
Yeah.
I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
I've
never seen this Bellers.
This is riveting.
I'll just wait
outside.
Okay, yeah, that's a great idea.
I'm going to put this right here.
And I just wanted to let you know this. Do you have just take a couple of these?
They're close on that.
I know. I think the other speaking features of the series. I'm using my passing that around. So this is the. Let me just pass out the syllabus real quick. That was amazing. Wow. I posted. You probably all got notification of this earlier today that it's been posted. I don't know how many of you had a chance to look at it. You did. Okay. No. Do you come over from Williamsburg or
from Richmond?
From Richmond. Okay. I wasn't sure. And tell me your name again.
Sarah
Mays. And this is Sarah. I don't think we sort of did introductions. So tell us something about you.
I have experience up in this place.
No.
I'm 30 and I'm majoring in biology and religious studies, minoring in bioethics, and I lost my voice.
Oh. Where are you from in Texas?
Houston.
Brooks is from Victoria.
Oh, okay.
I guess it's near Houston.
Well,
yeah.
Well, welcome. And then, So, quickly, let me just show you a couple of things here. I have to tell you, I'm actually a bit kind of stunned by that 2 hours. We just enjoy is not quite the word.